Okay, so first it's good to see everyone. Now moving to week two, where Uru was very excited to be able to say that now we welcome men to Ashir, which is a rare occurrence that the order is in that direction. Every so often you have to switch things up. So for those of you women who were here last week, welcome back. For the men, welcome. I know everyone. Women, I know some of you. Okay, so let me introduce it, and then we can decide how we work through it. I know Ora broke it up, right? Chavrusa, part of Shir, Chavrusa, part of Shir. We can do that. We can walk through it. We can do Chavrusa before, whatever you want. But let's introduce it. So obviously, during the 3 weeks, we have a series of customs, and then as we get closer to Tisha B'Av itself, actual halachot, in which we commemorate the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. Now, while the most intense period of the year in which we commemorate the Beit HaMikdash is this period, right? The 3 weeks starting with Shivat Esrei B'Tammuz and the tragedies associated with the Mikdash and not with the Mikdash that are commemorated on that day, culminating with Tisha B'Av, which commemorates, among other things, the destruction of both Beit HaMikdash. We have other halachot and customs and minhagim through the year, and a different life cycle events that also commemorate the Mikdash, right? And broadly speaking, we can put these all under a huge category of things that we do, Zecher LeMikdash, right? In commemoration of the Mikdash, it makes sense, right? The Mikdash is a central component of Jewish life, you know, when you read Tanakh, and in our life, it is not, right? We have to make an effort to make sure that the Mikdash has any resonance in our lives, right? It doesn't actually exist anymore, right? We hope that it will one day be rebuilt, but it hasn't been that way for thousands of years, right? And therefore, we have to go out of our way to ensure that the Mikdash is remembered, right? But even though we have many different customs of that kind, and they commemorate the Mikdash in radically different ways. And what I want to do in this year is explore the ways in which the different commemorations of the Mikdash accomplish fundamentally different goals in terms of how we integrate the Mikdash into our lives, despite it being bichurbana, right, despite the fact that it is destroyed and not yet rebuilt. And note that certain halachot, right, it's not clear their goal, right? So, like I said, we can do this however you want, but before we get into the sources, let's throw it out, get the conversation going. So if I asked you, okay, what things do we do during the year, right? Now this could be something that's attached to the calendar, or like I said, to life cycle events, to commemorate the Mikdash, but just know that once you throw something out, I'm then going to push you and say, okay, in what way is it commemorating the Mikdash, okay? I hope that's not too scary, but Uriel knows I can be scarier, because we're the only one in my Chabura who is here. Yeah, so you're the only one who had to endure it for a year, and I could give grades to. So it's less scary for anyone else, but I'll still push you, okay? So what things do we do to commemorate the Mikdash? Uriel.
We don't finish our house.
Meaning?
Right.
So one of them, now this is part of a series, which is here in number 4, which I won't look at now, but to throw it out, right? A series of things that we do to mourn the Mikdash, one of which, probably the most famous of that list, is that we leave a square amma unplastered, unpainted, opposite the door as we enter our house, right? That's clear Zecher LeMikdash. Okay, Uriel, now I throw it out to you. In what way does that commemorate the Mikdash, right? What is the mechanism by which that commemorates the Mikdash? How does it make us think about the Mikdash?
The reason is that, Hashem can have a home, we can have a home.
Right, so meaning, what is it doing, right? In what sense is it commemorating it? It's right? Yeah, or in a one word, it's mourning. Right? Meaning, it's an act of mourning, right? One way in which we commemorate the Mikdash is we do things that are sad. Right? We do things that are sad, right? We don't complete our house. Right? You know, you spend however, in Toronto, however many millions of dollars to for your house, right? For a knockdown that you have to redo, right? So you spend, $1.5 million on a knockdown, and then you spend another $1 million rebuilding it, and in the end, right, it's a new house, so you have to leave an amma by an amma unplastered, right? After all that work, right, that makes us feel sad. And if someone comes into your house and says, why, right, did you just spend $2.5 million on your house, right? And you didn't, you know, you ran out of the last, what, $5, right, for that last bit of paint, right? You'll say, no, it was an active decision to leave the house incomplete in order to mourn the lack of the Mikdash, right? So if we just think about that for a morning, what other things do we do that commemorate the Mikdash through the avenue of mourning? Yeah, Eitan. Good, right? We break the glass at the wedding, hence the right? I remember when Aaron and I got married, right? We were very insistent that we broke the glass, and you'll see this has become more common, during Im Eshkacheich, right? Because the whole notion of, right, of breaking the glass and then everyone saying Mazel Tov, right, totally misses the picture. Anyone who was ever in Aura's class might know the story. People in my class probably don't, but Aura had someone in her cohort in GPATS, who really wanted to feel the Mikdash at her wedding. So she said, look, you know, most of the time, right, those of you who are married know this, right? You go to the wedding, right, and the glass is provided by the caterer, right? Wrapped up nicely already in a white napkin, right? And then they just say, break it. And the only thing you're worried about at that point is, will I manage to break it, right? You're not sad, right? It's like a 50-cent, right, glass that you don't, that's not yours, right? The caterer owns it, right? This is built into the expense. But she wanted to feel the Mikdash. So what she did was, she's an interesting person. She's very creative. She learned how to blow glass in anticipation of her wedding, spent the time to blow an artistic glass that she spent time on, and then they broke that glass, so you actually feel sad, right? So, hey, look, whatever works, I commend her, right? That is like really attempting to, you have time to learn how to blow glass, you know? So, you know, look, and you know, at a wedding, what else do we do? Zecher l'Mikdash. Yeah, the ashes, right? You put the ashes on the head, right? Same idea, right? And now, obviously, what we started with, right? The 3 weeks, all the halachot / minhagim that have accrued over this period are of this genre, right? Meaning, kinot, for example, on Tisha B'Av is, right, literally, you sit there and you say lamentations, elegies, whatever you want to translate it, for hours on end, right? That is straight up mourning for the Mikdash, and we think about the Mikdash by crying over it, right? So we have a whole host of halachot and minhagim which fit in this category, okay? But there are many other things which are zecher l'mikdash which do not fit that paradigm, at least not obviously. So let's. I mean, I can throw it out and ask you to think of one, or I can give you hints, whatever you want, right? Yeah, Uriel.
Like the Pesach Seder.
Yeah, what do we do with the Pesach Seder?
Good,
a Korech, right? Korech, we say, Zecher l'Mikdash k'Hillel, right? Now, that's only the most obvious of the Seder. What else, by the way, is Zecher l'Mikdash at the Seder? What? So, what's her name, by the way? Tamina Tova. Right, the Zroah, right? Good. What else?
The Afikomen.
The Afikomen, which is Zecher l'Korban Pesach. What else? Maybe the Beitza, right, which is Zecher l'Chagiga. What else? The Maror, right, which is Dirabanan, because, right, it was instituted post Korban, because biblically you only have to have Maror if you have a Korban Pesach, right? Most of the Seder, right, is actually Zecher, right? Zecher l'Mikdash. In fact, it's worse than that, right? It's worse than that. There's a fascinating article by Raviel Benun where he points out that Shimi's already smiling. It's like, what is Raviel going to say, right? He's not the only one to say it, but right, Manishtana is weird. Right? Because Manishtana assumes that the kid already knows what's weird coming, right? Right? So why do we do that? Right? So Raviol notes, because probably the Seder is purposely modeled after the Mikdash, and the Mikdash, he already would have seen it, because you eat the Korban Pesach first, right? So in the Mikdash, you would have had Matzah and Maror, right? And Korban Pesach at the beginning, and then you would have told the story afterwards, right? So we model the Seder after the Mikdash, and Manishtana is purposely out of place, right? Because it maintained the ordered structure of the Mikdash Seder, right? So Pesach, now, if I asked you, okay, Hilly's like, that is Like, they're just like, the light went off. It's like, yeah, it's a good fart. So, but if I ask you, in what way does that commemorate the Mikdash? Is that mourning? No, so what is it? Right, so part of it might just be like, I don't know, yeah, it's a memento, right? It's like, you know, something to remind us. Like, it's not like sad.
It's trying to recreate.
So those are two very different ways of looking at it, right? One is to say, we just sort of put things, like it's like having a picture of the Mikdash, but instead of a picture, we put, you know, we do Korech. But the other way is to say, no, maybe what it's doing is it's subtly saying, look, the Mikdash may be gone, but how we commemorate the Mikdash? By recreating life in the Mikdash. Even though the Mikdash isn't here, we're going to continue life sort of as if it were, but draw attention to the fact that these practices have someone been emptied of meaning. Right? Meaning, Moror was once biblical, now it is rabbinic. Korech once had a Karban Pesach in it, now it does not. Right? But we will continue to do it because life continues post-Mikdash. Right? Now, if I frame it that way, is that sad or happy? Well, I don't know, right? Right? Well, justify both. It's sort of both, right? In what sense is it happy? As Eitan said, it was happy. Why is it happy? Right, meaning in one sense, you'll say, well, life continues, right? Meaning you might have thought, well, you know, we won't have, I guess Maror is not the best example, but we don't have Maror, right, for all of history, because the Mikdash isn't here, right? But no, we will have Maror, it'll just be rabbinic, right? And to be fair, most people don't know that it's only rabbinic, right?
Big.
Right? What?
It's a big tragedy, but it's not the end of the
world. Right, right. So there's an optimistic spin on it. Yeah, Orly? Right, or hopeful for the future, right? So that's, right, there's two ways of saying it's happy, right? Either life has continued, or it's a function of Mehira Yibaneh Beit HaMikdash, right? Meaning, it's not inherently happy, it's just that we have optimism for the future, right? Those are two different ways of being happy. Alternatively, it could be sad. How could it be sad?
It's a constant reminder of
that. Yeah, right, meaning it's, you're reliving it and feeling that it's emptied. Right, like we're trying to relive life as much as possible, right? And at some level, that's actually sadder than like breaking the glass, right? Right, like think like which is sadder, right? If you're at a wedding, right, where we've all been at weddings, like the first one, maybe not the second, right? The first one, you have a wedding, no one's lost any relatives in the recent, right, past. It's just like, you know, the grandparents died at a ripe old age many years ago, right? The pain of someone lost. But in the speech, right, when they say, you know, I'd like to thank or acknowledge or whatever, I know that Zeta this is watching from Shamayim, right? Yes, it's sort of sad, but it's not like viscerally, right? You don't like feel it. Like they died 20 years ago at a ripe old age and, you know, This is how life works. Maybe it's the great grandfather. I don't know, right? So not people don't always see the great grand, you know, their great grandchildren's wedding, and then there are weddings where, you know, the relative passed away. You know, I mean, I've been to weddings like this. You know, the halacha is you can continue the wedding if, let's say, the parent of the bride or the groom die, and you're in the middle of you're still in the middle of shiva. If the wedding is already planned, you can continue, right there. Right, you try to continue the wedding as much as possible, right? But the fact that you're continuing the wedding and there's like a gaping hole, right, is the worst reminder, right? Like you're trying to continue the happy event as if nothing happened, but the fact that there's, you know, that gaping hole, that the parent isn't there, makes you cry, right? That's more painful than the explicit, this is a, let's take a moment to remember our dearly departed relatives, right? So, which is Pesach, right? Is it life has continued, that's happy, but every so often we acknowledge the Mikdash, or is it, we're going to relive it, and then we're going to get to Manashtana, and you're going to be like, wait, but why, how is it obvious, right? Oh, because it used to be that a Seder didn't look anything like it does right now. That's really sad, right? Right, it draws attention to it. So it's not clear, right? Is that a happy, it's a different type of commemoration of the Mikdash, right? But it's not clear whether it's happy, whether it's sad, right? So just this, right? Just from like these few examples, what becomes clear is that, yes, we do all these things during the year, which are Zecher LeMikdash, right? Which commemorate the Mikdash, But we do very different things to commemorate the Mikdash, right? And we, right, the way it speaks to our experience, right, comes from many different angles, right? And the most interesting are the halachot that it's not clear which one they belong to, right? Because some of them are obvious and some of them are not obvious, right? And trying to figure out what they're trying to accomplish and what implications that might have for the actual formulation of the halacha or the custom is interesting. And also trying to figure out which of these we prioritize. Which of these are our main goals in commemorating the Mikdash is important if we want to figure out, right, how do we move forward? How do we develop more minhagim? Or whatever it might be. Okay? So now, from there, we can go about this different ways, right? We can break up into chavrusa, rejoin, do that multiple times, just have chavrusa for a bit, and then have shir, or we can just sort of have, you know, back and forth conversation and go through the sources together. I don't really care. It's however the dynamic is going to work. I think people said, the people who were here last week liked the model, right, of small chavrusas and then shir. Okay, so here's what we'll do. Let's take like 15, 20 minutes, and perhaps one of the weirdest of these examples, it's a one-liner, right, is the source of number one, is Sfirat HaOmer. So let's take 15, 20 minutes, go through Sfirat HaOmer. Anything that I'd already had translated on an old version of this, I didn't take away the translation, I just felt like that was mean. If it's already there, you don't have to use it. Right, in some places, I would take off translation because they would like think I'm not serious if I put translation on it. Because, you know, who do you think we are? We only use Hebrew, right? But I figured I already had it. So, like, if you want to use it, it's there. So let's try to get through 1, 2, the Sfat Emet, the Ran, and number 3. And then number 4, right, is the Gemara that Uriel alluded to before, the right some of the mourning practices that we have that at first glance are clearly of the very, very sad kind. But I want you to read that Gemara and see if maybe there's another way of reading it, and we'll reconvene, let's say, in 15, 20 minutes. Right, that should be fine in those sources, and then we'll go from there, okay? So let's reconvene for a little bit. Okay, so I put as the first source here, probably, you know, in talking to some people in Chavrusa, one of the most surprising of the Zeichel Mikdash appearances in Shas, and probably one of the last ones that you would have put on that list, right? And proof, no one threw that out as their example when I asked for Zeichel Mikdash. But I also think it is a good place to start if we want to highlight the complexity of the ways in which we commemorate the Mikdash, because it is not at all an obvious Zeichel HaMikdash, right? So let's just go through it. I gave you just the one key line, right? So the context in the Gemara is, the Gemara is, records the dispute as to how we count Sfirat HaOmer nowadays, right? Now, right, obviously when we talk about Sfirat HaOmer, right, even though most people, when you talk to them about Sfirah, they jump to the post-Gaonic mourning practices, right, of Sfirah, whatever those right might be, weddings and haircutting, etc. Right, Sfirat HaOmer, biblically, classically, is simply the mitzvah of counting from the 16th of Nisan until right 50 days later, 49 days later, right to what we call Shavuot. Now, in the Psukim, right, Sfirat HaOmer is connected to what mitzvah? Right, the Karban HaOmer, right? And the Pasuk says, Mehachel Chermesh Bakama, from when you cut down. Right? The Omer, right? From when you start the reaping, the Omer, you bring the Karban HaOmer, so you start counting. Right? Hence, you get a dispute in the Gemara that carries over into the Rishonim, is counting the Omer nowadays biblical or rabbinic? Okay, so in this sort of context about the nature of the mitzvah, we pick up as follows. So the Gemara says, Gufa, Amar Abaye. Right now, on a biblical level, the mitzvah is to count weeks and days. That's how we count. Right? And there's a bit of a machloket. What does that mean? Right? Does that mean that the way sort of the Ashkenazi minhag that you count, today is 8 days, which is 1 day and 1 week? Or you count the days, and at the end of each week, you count the week, right? Different ways you do it. Is that one mitzvah? Is it two mitzvot? Right? Many different, right? If you're giving a shir just on Sfira, we could get into the relationship between all those mitzvot. But in the meantime, Abaye says, mitzvah l'mimnei yomei, mitzvah l'mimnei shavuei. Abaye says the mitzvah is to count days and weeks. Rabbanan de Beir of Ashi, manu yomei, umanu shavuei, and that was in fact the practice of the people in the Beit Midrash of Ravashi. Ameimar, mani yomei, velo mani shavuei, amar zecher l'mikdash hu. But Ameimar introduces this odd position that he would count the days and not the weeks, because it is, I will just translate it, but there are many ways you could translate this, and it's going to hang on what I'm about to say, right? He would count days and not weeks. Zecher l'mikdashu, okay? It is a commemoration. Now, let's try to figure out what that line meant, okay? Now, first of all, I just gave you, in number three, I gave you the Ran, right, that the Ran notes that there is a machloket amongst the Rishonim, whether, in fact, we rule that this is biblical or rabbinic, meaning do we accept the conclusion of the Gemara here, right? Clearly, a Maimar's position that this is rabbinic, but that is, it's not clear whether the Abaye's position is that it is biblical, and that's why we count fully days and weeks, or is it also rabbinic, but we still count days and weeks, right? I mean, he notes that Rov, this is number three, Rov Mefarshim Maskim Disfir Omer Achshav Deleka Avav Elo Karban Ein El Midr Rabbanan. The majority position we've shown him is that it is merely rabbinic, because we don't have the Sfir, we don't have the Karban Homer to count from. But the Rambam says that it is biblical. Right? Parenthetically, this is one of the many problems with, in many shuls, and you might get annoyed at me, right? You have this bizarre practice that whether you say L'Shem Yichud ever, right? L'Shem Yichud, you know, the Kabbalistic in, right? Whatever exactly it is, right? Whatever it is, we won't get into that. But whether or not you normally say that before mitzvot, right? It's become this musical accompaniment in shul that they have a whole song for Hinni Muchanu Mezuman L'Kayim Mitzvah Aseh Shel Torah. I'm not going to sing it and embarrass myself. Someone else can if they want. L'kayim mitzvah aseh, right? Except that's according to almost no Rishonim, right? Besides for the problem of L'shem Yichud and the weirdness that is inherent in it, if you don't know Kabbalah and you don't know what it means that God is separated and then you are marrying the two sides, the male and feminine side of God, that's what those words mean. L'shem Yichud Kudsha Brichu Ushchinte, right? Which in Kabbalah language means the marrying of the sixth sphere of Yesod to the seventh sphere of Shechina. If anyone knows what I just said, right? Great. If not, don't say it, right? Okay. That's not my, that was part of the Nodi Yehuda's claim, right? He's like, look, I don't know what it means, but you definitely don't know what it means, right? Don't say it if you don't know what you're talking about. Okay. But now let's go to this dispute here. The final position of Ameimar says that counting Sfirat Omer is Zecher Lemikdash, and therefore you only count days and not weeks. So how would you actually translate? There's a word that I didn't put in, right? But I think has to be put in to properly translate for Ameimar, right? Ameimar says, we only count partially because Zecher Lemikdash. What word should I put in English? Right? It is blank, a commemoration of the temple. Right, only, merely, right? Meaning, it is not what you think it is, right? Now, it's not clear whether what Abaye thinks, but it's clear that Ameimar thinks counting Sfirat Omer is merely a Zecher LeMikdash, right? Meaning, that's the implication of what he says. And therefore, the classic full mitzvah is, today is 8 days, which is a week and 1 day to the Omer, and now we just say it is 8 days and we leave a gaping hole. Because it is merely a commemoration of the Mikdash. Okay? What does Abaye think? Right? When Abaye says you count days and weeks, so why does he think you count days and weeks? So either, right, so what possibilities do we have?
If there is a Mikdash,
Right? Either it's d'oraisa, right? He holds, right, the way the Rambam ends up ruling, that it is biblical, right? It is a complete biblical mitzvah. Or even, it's a complete rabbinic mitzvah, but it's not this mere commemoration of the Mikdash that you talk about. It's a rabbinic mitzvah, which is modeled on the biblical mitzvah. Or, right, so one possibility is they're arguing about whether or not Sfirat HaOmer is a mere commemoration of the Mikdash, or it's biblical. What's the other possibility? That they're arguing not about whether it's commemoration of the Mikdash, but they're arguing about that word that I made Jay put in, which is merely, right? Meaning maybe they both agree that it is Zecher LaMikdash, but they don't agree in what way one would commemorate the Mikdash. Right? So now let's go back to the models we set up, and now let's try to think about it the second way. Let's say that everybody agreed that nowadays Sfirat HaOmer is only rabbinic. It's not biblical because we don't have the Karban HaOmer, and we only count Sfira because it's a commemoration of the Mikdash. It's Zecher HaMikdash. Why would you say that when I am creating a commemoration of the Omer, that I would create a complete reenactment of the Mikdash? And why would you say that I would commemorate the Mikdash by sort of cutting off a limb from the mitzvah, right? Right? Making it very obviously impaired, right? What is the difference between those two? What do you think? Right, right? Meaning, one way to say it is, look, maybe they both think that Sfirat HaOmer is a commemoration of the Mikdash. But there are, as we said at the beginning, there are different ways to commemorate. You can commemorate by saying, life continues, right? So we relive. How do we relive? Before we counted days and weeks, now we count days and weeks. Now, that could be happy, that could be sad, right? We saw that there could be two spins on that. That could be happy, life continues, that could be sad. Look, we're basically doing everything we did before in the Mikdash, but we used to start that whole process from the cutting of the Omer, and now we do it missing that very, right, that very grand opening. But either way, what you're saying is that the way we commemorate is through reliving. And Amemar says, no. The way you commemorate, or at least in the context of Sfirat HaOmer, is you get rid of the mitzvah and you replace it with a memento. Right? It's a mere Zecher HaMikdash. Right? So it could be that the dispute here is not, is the mitzvah biblical or just a commemoration of the Mikdash? It's maybe everyone agrees this is a commemoration of the Mikdash. Right? That's what the Ran says. Right? Everyone agrees this is rabbinic, except for the Rambam. Right? The only question is, how does one go about commemorating the Mikdash? Do you do it by saying, look, our life is missing something, right? Let's draw attention to the fact that our life is missing something and just create some mementos for the Mikdash, but basically, right, make our religious life lacking, right? Count Sfira, but only with the days, not the weeks. Or do you say, no, the way I commemorate the Mikdash is, at some level, I continue to live as if the Mikdash stands, right? I recreate the Mikdash experience. And those are both ways of commemorating the Mikdash. Right? Those are both ways of commemorating the Mikdash, but the tone of that commemoration, right? The pathos, if you will, of the commemoration, right? The emotional backdrop of those commemorations are radically different, right? One is hopeful, optimistic, right, has a level of I can continue despite the Mikdash, and the other one is no, our religious life is lacking, right? The best we can do is just like remind ourselves there was once a time where we did this beautiful mitzvah called Sfirat HaOmer, and now, like, you know, we sort of mark it, but not in any complete way. Now, if you look at the Sfar Emet in number 2, see that this question of what exactly the words Zecher HaMikdash mean, right, are relevant to his question. So he says, I'm shocked. I don't understand this. He said, I don't understand. Let's say it is a commemoration of the Mikdash. So you can commemorate the Mikdash by continuing life as if it were before the Mikdash. You can do that. The Efshar Lefareish Demamed Beparshat Re'eh Kaz of Stam Shiva Shavuot Tisbar Lach Vasita Chag Shavuot V'sham Lo Nizkar Me'omer Shdeilechem Klal Im Kein Mash Mitzvot Tzuras V'Iletzorech Chag HaShavuot Be'atzmo Shebe'emet Nikra Kein Shavuot. So now he introduces a very complex argument, which is, in the Psukim, it sounds like there are two components to Sefirat HaOmer. One, which is that which counts towards Shavuot, and one which counts from the Karban HaOmer. And he says, V'lachein yesh l'omer dahani shtei mitzvot sefirat HaOmer mitzad hakravat HaOmer shtei alechem u'sefirat HaShavuot l'shem chag ba'atzmo. Right? And he introduces this very novel approach, which is counting days are, right? The counting days and the counting weeks have different functions entirely. Right? The counting of weeks is towards Shavuot. The counting of days is the mitzvah which is connected to the Karbanot, from the Omer to the Shtei HaLechem. I mean, he says, "Usfira Shavuot l'shem Achag ba'atzmo, v'hasht Amar Amimar to call him mitzvot she'ino agin bezman hazeh lo matzino lahem zecher, rak mitzvot she'ino agin b'mikdash asu zecher l'mikdash, u'la'achi mani yome zecher l'mikdash." So he makes this very convoluted argument, which is both the mitzvah which count from the Karban and that which counts for Shavuot are mikdash central, meaning they are based on the Karban. But when we set up a zecher l'mikdash, we only commemorate the things that commemorate that which actually happened in the Mikdash. And since the day count is connected to the bringing of the Karbanot, we remember that one. And the counting of weeks, which is like dependent on the Mikdash, but not like visual, you know, when you sort of imagine it, right? Shavuot is not Mikdash oriented, so that we leave to the side. Now, whether you buy his argument, don't buy his argument, right? Again, there's not a shiur on Sefirat HaOmer, so I don't want to get bogged down in it. But what is, right, what is the assumption of the whole of the Sefirat HaOmer? Right? The Sefirat HaOmer is bothered by the notion that a Zecher L'Mikdash should be anything other than a complete replica of a mitzvah that exists in the Mikdash. And he's so bothered by the possibility that one would construct a mitzvah which is a mere memento. Right, there's a mere commemoration. What does he do? He invents two categories of mitzvot and says, no, they both agree that you fully replicate the mitzvah. The only question is, right, is there one big mitzvah or are there in fact two mitzvot and you're replicating one of them? Right, but he can't buy this notion, right, that you would just do a sort of token commemoration of the Mikdash. Right, that doesn't enter his mind as a possibility. Right? The easy answer is that no, Abaye and Amema are arguing along these lines and saying, look, yes, it's Zecher LeMikdash, but you can commemorate the Mikdash in two ways. One is by living through, pushing through and saying, life continues after the Mikdash, so we'll do exactly what did in the Mikdash. And the other is, no, we will actively hamstring the mitzvah. Right? So we'll do it, but we'll feel that it's lacking. Right? Both of them want to commemorate the Mikdash, but one is an optimistic, right, way of commemorating by saying we will get through this and the Mikdash is still part of our lives because look, we're doing Mikdash as things without a Mikdash, and the other one's saying no, the way we want to commemorate the Mikdash is by mourning, by calling attention to the fact that our life is, you know, is partially emptied. Okay. Now, number four, right? So Zohar's number four. Sefirat HaOmer, like I said, here, right, you see that you can have attention, right, even within those, right, even within the position that what we're doing is commemorating the Mikdash, you can have attention as to how do you do that, right, by mourning or by showing that we continue to live post Mikdash. Now, number four is part of the series of mourning practices that are clearly mourning, right? I mean, this is not a, right, there's much less doubt on this one. Right, where we say, "En misaiden, vein mechairin, vein mafichim bezman hazeh." We don't plaster, tile, paint images in the present, etc. I cut out in the middle the exact parameters of that, right? The Amma and the Amma, but all those halachot. I think everyone can agree on that line. That this type of Zecher HaMikdash is mourning. Right? It's sad. Right? It's sad. But Things get a bit more complicated when we continue. The Gemara continues and tells a story. Tana Rabbana, Kishacharava Baita Beshniya, Rabu Prushin B'Yisrael Shalola Echol Basar V'Shalola Shtot Yayin. There were people who were particularly from, they were ascetics, or Prushin can sometimes mean like ascetics, it can sometimes refer specifically to the Pharisees. I assume here it doesn't, right, mean just the Pharisees, because that's, you know, essentially the rabbinic group. Pachot o Yoter. But there were people who said, look, let's never eat meat or never drink wine. Right? What we do during the 9 days, let's just do that forever. Right? We're so sad. We're always going to be sad. Let's mourn forever. Nidba lehen Rabbi Yeshua. Amar len. Banai. Mipnei ma. Yetem ochlim basav. Yetem shotin yayin. So Rabbi Yeshua said, my children, why exactly are you not eating meat and not drinking wine? So Amru lo, nochal basar shemenu makriven al gamam mizbeach, v'achshav batel. How can we eat meat? When we eat meat, we think of karbanot, because we used to sacrifice meat. I can't do it, right? I can't think about meat. It makes me think about the mikdash. I'm not doing it. Right? I don't know if this is emotional, right? I just can't think about it. I don't know if it's theological, right? God isn't having his meat, whatever that means, right? Not in an idolatrous sense, right? The mikdash isn't having its meat, so I'm not going to. Nishtei yayin sheminaschin al gabim mizbeach v'achshav batel. We're not going to drink wine because, you know, we used to pour libations, right? I pour it and oy vey, God doesn't have his wine. Omer lam, so he says to them, right, really, right? By that logic, imkein lechem lo nochal shekvar bat lo minachot. Good, so don't have bread. Right, don't have bread because, you know, there are meal offerings. So, you know, this is the chumrah of the week competition. You think that you're going to one up them, say, your logic takes you to this chumrah, you're not going to accept that. And then they say, aha, it's a great chumrah. So he says, Efshar b'peirot, right? We'll have fruit. So they say, peirot. No, there were fruit offerings, admittedly, once a year. Right, Bikurim, but that, you know, it lasted like 6 months, right? You could bring it from Shavuot to Hanukkah. So, Efshar B'Peirot Acharim, they said, fine, we'll eat fruit that are not from the Shivat HaMinim, right? We'll live on oranges, right? Oranges, apples, and bananas. Okay, that will be the entirety of our diet. And, I don't know, some almonds and cashews for protein and healthy fats, and like, we'll be great. Okay, we'll be biotic vegans. Don't joke, I've had friends who are biotic vegans. So he says, Mayim lo nishteh. He says, fine, I got you. Don't drink water. Because water, on Sukkot, we have water libations. Because shikvar batel nisachamayim shatku. So they gave up, right? They were quiet. So amr lehen banai bo'ov amr lechem shalud abel al ikar yefshar shikvar nigzara gzera l'dabel yoter midai yefshar she'en gozrin gzera ala tzibur elm ken rov tzibur yecholin la'amod ba'dechtiv me'ratem ne'irim v'oti atem kovim hagoy kulo elakach amru chachamim saladam et beito besir meshair bo davar mawad. He says, listen, you can't not mourn at all because the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, but you can't mourn the way you want because, like, people can't handle that, right? Life moves, right, continues on after the Mikdash. People can't handle that type of extremism. So instead, what we should do is build your house, but leave a square amma unplastered. Now, here's where things get a bit tricky. If you read just the first line of the Gemara, right, don't fully plaster your house. And I asked you, is this Gemara a sad or a happy, hopeful, optimistic commemoration of the Mikdash? What would you have said? If you just read the first line. Right? Don't, right, leave your house incomplete. What would you have said? I would have said sad. I don't know. That's what I would have said, okay? After this dialogue between Rabbi Yeshua and the Prushin, is that obvious? Right? Is it still sad? Yeah, Bella. Right, so now there's two very different ways of reading Rabbi Yeshua, right? One is, look, it's sad, but you can't be that sad just because, like, it's just not practical, right? But really, I agree with you, right? I mean, one way of reading Rabbi Yeshua is saying, look, really, I'd love to be crying all day, not eating meat, not drinking wine, not, but what am I going to do, right? I can't drink water, like, we'll just all die, right? But fundamentally, he agrees with them that certain mourning practices in the Mikdash are just pure sadness. He just disagrees with the extremes to which the normal human being can survive. But there's this excellent article by Rav Uri Rodman, which I printed out if anyone wants to look at it, on Zechar HaMikdash, where he notes that this dialogue suggests that even in the midst of what's clearly a mourning practice, it's not clear that it's all sad either. Because there's another way of reading Rabbi Shua, like Bella suggests, which is, no, Rabbi Shua is actually coming back with an optimistic critique, which is not, I agree with you, we should be miserable, but we won't survive. Right? If I can't drink water, I won't survive. He's saying, look, we don't want to be mourning all the time. We choose certain symbolic mourning practices so that we can continue. Right? We light a yahrzeit candle on the yahrzeit so that we don't need to cry all day, every day, because we lost a relative. Right? We do symbolic acts, which on the one hand are sad. Right? No one says that lighting a yahrzeit candle is happy. But picking a day during the year where we mourn, right, where we commemorate, allows us to do everything else normally. Right? So on the one hand, yes, right, not finishing our house and not plastering it is sad. But it's not pure sadness, right? You could read Rabbi Shua's argument with the Prushin as, don't let sadness overcome your life, because life isn't over. Right? Pick symbolic acts so that you don't forget the Mikdash, and then, right, because he didn't say to them, look, you know, I agree with you, let's not drink wine on Monday, Thursday, right? I mean, he could have come back and said, like, you know, I fundamentally agree with you, I'm sad, let's just cut it down a little bit, right, to what people can handle. He goes from one extreme to the other, which is, you can't do everything, so instead, let's limit it to one square amma, right? Yeah, Shimmy.
Which sounds like, yeah, we should be doing all these things 100% if we were able to.
Good. So what Shimmy notes is that whether this is true, whether what I just said is true, which I'm not sure, right? You can go either way, right? It depends on how seriously you take that line, right? Because Rabbi Shua's argument is, the reason we don't do this is because people can't handle it, right? Now, if he means that literally, which is, I would like to do it, but people can't handle it, so I won't. Right, I mean, the way it is used elsewhere in Shas, the way it's used in Avodah Zarah Lamed Vav, right, in the classics, so yeah, so sure. Then it means, I'm sad, I just can't really go that far, and I will decree as much mourning as is humanly possible. Right? It can also be that he's not using this phrase formally, halachically, which is what you get in the next Gemara. Now this Gemara happens to be, you don't have to take my word for it, I'll show you one more example. This Gemara happens to have a series of very strange moments where it utilizes halachic phrases in hyperbolic ways, right? In ways that aren't halachic. If this is an example, right? So then it would negate. But you're right, Shimmy. If you take this line literally, then Rabbi Shua is clearly the sad side of this equation, right? If you take it not literally, then you open the possibility that he's the sadness mixed with, right, a level of realism or optimism. I don't know if you want to call it optimism. I don't know if that's really the right word, but of, right, optimistic pragmatism? I don't know. Right? Something like that. Yeah, Bella.
Also, the whole progression of, no wine to produce, so water, that whole thing is speaking hyperbole in a sense.
Correct. I mean, the whole thing does feel hyperbolic, right? Because, right, meaning, don't drink wine, don't eat meat, don't drink water, right? You can't do that, let's leave an amma by an amma, right? Meaning, there was a middle ground in between, right? If it really meant, right, it strictly, literally, right, you would expect something in the middle, but again, it can go either way. Now, the Gemara continues with very, very shocking lines. Right, I gave you the rest. Now, some of them are not. Right, some of them are not. Right, the Gemara says, "Osha them called sarchesu dao mishayer davar muat." You should. One of the things you should do is you should make a full meal, but leave out one dish. Now, all the modern poskim say, we just don't do this. Why don't we do this? Because you would have no idea. Right, how many times have you gone to somebody's house and you're like, you could have left out half the dishes and no one would have noticed, right? Like, right? You know, it's like every time, we come back, like the first week I come back, right? So like, we came back to visit a few weeks ago, so it was me and my brother-in-law and my sister-in-law, Like, everyone was here except for one sibling. So, like, my mother-in-law was very excited, right? So you come Friday night, and there was lamb and brisket and chicken, right? Like, you would go if you pulled out one of those, right? One of those mains. Oh, I left that, of course, right? Everyone would say, you had two mains, right? They wouldn't say, oh, you, right? So nowadays, the post can say, like, no, you know, we have, like, 300 dishes. No one has any idea if you left out a dish. Okay, fine. But you skip down, the Gemara then says, Tanya, Amar Bishmol ben Elisha, Miyom Shecharav Beit HaMikdash, Dinu Shenigzor Al Atzmenu Shelo Lachol Basar Velo Shot Yayin. Since the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, we should not eat meat, not drink wine. Ella, Ein Gozrin Gzera Al Tzibor Al Ken Rov Al Tzibor Yechol and Lamod Bab. We don't make decrees unless the community can handle it. Miyom Shepashta Malchut Arisha, and from the day that the evil empire has taken control, and we have all these evil decrees, and it forbids us from performing mitzvot. Yeshua ben, he doesn't allow us to perform one of the mitzvot that we do at the beginning of a baby's life. It's not clear what, right? That's the different versions there. We should stop having children. Not get married, not have children. Period. End of story. And then the Jewish people will just, right, they'll just disappear. Right? They'll just, that's the proper reaction. Ella hanach lahem liYisrael. Mutav shiyushog begin v'alyum uzidin. But what can you do? Let Jews do things by accident and not on purpose. Right? Now, Shimi, that phrase, when it's used elsewhere in Shas, is very strictly halachic. Right? It means literally, if someone is performing an Avera by accident, and you know they're going to continue even if you tell them that it's wrong, don't tell them because you will turn them from accidental violators of a sin into intentional violators of the sin. Tosud points out that it doesn't mean that here because
you're an
anus. It's more than anus. They weren't gozer. Because it was impossible, they never set up the gzera. Right? So you're not a violator. Right? Right? It's let them do something that theoretically should have been usher. Right? But it's not, right? So you're playing a bit fast and loose here with halachic phrases, right? Now, this Gemara is very weird because you could take this Gemara at many levels. You could say that this is all hyperbole, right? And that's like, the Chassam Sofer goes in that direction, right? He says, right? I mean, the simplest way is just to say, like, this is just, you know, oh, woe is us, right? Life is terrible. We don't want life to continue. Let's all die, but you know, we can't really do that, so we'll move on, right? It could just be sad, right? Sad hyperbole, right? Eov-esque. The Chassam Sofer says something like that, right? He says, what it means is that God promises he'll never let the Jews be destroyed, so what we should do is we should have created a situation where the Jews would, right, we would just stop having kids, so the Jews would be about to die out, and we'd force God's hand, like Moshe Rabbeinu, right? To come in and swoop in and save us from this, right? From this Gehenna that we're living, right? Which is, I guess, Jean Valjean, but with Gehenna replacing hell that we're living. Or is it someone? No, it's not. It's one of them. What? Okay, it's the other one. I know it's somewhere in lameness. Whatever. You know, I'm like, that feels like a Broadway play. Anyways, so that's a Chassam Sofer. Now, Tosfot actually takes this quasi-halachically. Not actually halachically, but halachic theoretical. Right? He says, how could you say such a thing? Right? How could you say such a thing? It goes against a mitzvah in the Torah called Pru Revu. You're supposed to get married and have children. Answer? It means that you won't have children after you have a boy and a girl. Right? Like, it doesn't literally mean we'll die. It just means, like, you'll slowly, but right? If replacement is 2.1, right? Right? So, we'll stop at 2 and slowly but surely, right? You'll disappear, right? Something like that. But the Mordechai took this very strictly halachically. I won't read it inside, but number 7, the Mordechai says no. The Gemara in Yevamot tells us that if a couple is married for 10 years and they don't have children, so they, right, from the din of the Gemara, you have to get divorced. Now, whether this is halachal maisa, right? The Rama says it's not, but the reason that the Rama says it's not based on the Rivash is just we don't force people. It's halacha and kfiya, we don't force. But the Mordechai says no. This Gemara tells us that Puruvu basically, right, in its real form, Puruvu doesn't exist anymore. Like, we live in such a mourning, like, such a depressed state that really, 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 we shouldn't be having children. So, like, there was a time when having children was so important that if a couple couldn't have children, we would force them to get divorced so that they could have children, right? Try with a different partner. But nowadays, we shouldn't be having children anyway. So you can't have children. It's a tragedy, but none of us should be having children. Right? So like, the Mordechai reads this super halachically. But why do I bring this up? Right? And by the way, this is quoted by the Beis Shmuel on Shulchan Aruch. Right? Beis Shmuel being one of the two main commentators in Eben Ezer. In Siman Aleph, this is not like you have to look very far. It's the first Siman in Eben Ezer. Right? You don't have to look very far for this halacha. I mention this not just because, right, it highlights, you know, some of the complexities in Gemara, but coming back to our broader theme, right, you see, if you think this Gemara is fundamentally, everyone in the Gemara is depressed, right, and is saying we should get in as much mourning as possible, right, then you can lead to certain conclusions like the Mordechai, which is, right, as much as possible, we will make these mourning true. I mean, I won't actually tell you to not have children, but like, if you're married, you're not having children. So, you know, we can't tell you not to have children. But if you're not having children by yourself, so, okay. You know, that's what everyone should be doing anyways. Right? Not having children. Just, you know, we can't get rid of the mitzvah for Revu. But like, you know, anybody else, we tell them to get married. And like, right? Meaning, he clearly takes this very seriously as on the mourning side of this. This is sad. And as much sadness we can get in, right, we will. So if the average person, going back to Shimmy's thing, we can't tell you don't get married. But if someone got married and didn't have children, we can say, don't get divorced, you won't have children. That's what really we should be all doing. Right? But if you think that what Rabbi Yeshua is really saying is no, right? We minimize our mourning, but fundamentally life continues, then you're not gonna say, well, having a family doesn't really exist nowadays. It's just a concession to human weakness. You're gonna say no. Right? Whatever exactly the halacha is, right? Again, I don't want to get into the halacha maisa of this, but we would encourage people, at least, to build a family, and that would have halachic implications. So there are real consequences to, when you read this Gemara, what type of mourning is going on, right? Is this an absolute mourning as much as possible, but we cut it short when people can't handle it? Or is this symbolic mourning with a conviction that life continues? Right? That has halachic, not just like philosophic implications. That has practical implications in terms of how do you adjudicate these laws in their most complex manifestations. Okay. Okay, I don't think we're going to have time for chavrusa, so we'll do this more as we'll learn together the next one. So we've set up different models, right? We've said that sometimes you have these mourning practices that are just sad. They're just mourning. Sometimes you have ones which are, we're going to get through this. Let's keep life going, right? Now, as we said, right, that at a certain level seems to be korich, right? Right. We talked about these. I didn't give you all the sources inside, but some of them that you know, right, the Seder stuff, right, like korich and maror at some level really feel like that level. The person in, and this has been pointed out by several academics, rabbis, academics, rabbis were more academically oriented, probably. The person in Chazal who really, 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 really believed this, who really lived this and said the best way to commemorate the Mikdash is not by being sad, but by pushing through and proving to ourselves that we can continue life, was Rabbi Yochanan. Right? Rabbi Yochanan seems to have a position throughout Shas that this is what it means to commemorate the Mikdash. Not to cry all day, but to say we're not going to give up despite the fact that the Mikdash doesn't exist. So if you look at number eight, okay? So you get as follows. The Mishnah says, Barishona hayahu lulav nital b'mikdash shiv'a uvimindina yom echad. Originally, you would take the arbaminim, you would take the lulav in the Mikdash for 7 days, and outside the Beit HaMikdash, only one day. Right? Only on the first day. Mishacharav Beit HaMikdash, but once the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, Hitkin Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Shehei lulav nital b'medina shiv'a, Zecher le-Mikdash. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says that now, outside the Mikdash, you take the Arbaminim all 7 days. Now, let's analyze just that statement for a moment. What is shocking about that line? Right, let's just unpack this Mishnah, right? What did Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai say? Right, in the time of the Mikdash, yeah, Haley.
So we're not just going about how we usually like
the Yeah, right? Meaning, what have we seen so far? So far we've seen a Zichel Mikdash, mourning, right? Token mourning that allows us to continue normal life, or continuing mitzvah that existed in the Mikdash, despite the fact that you're not really obligated, right? But Rabbi Yochanan ben, right, introduces a fourth level, which is maybe the best way to commemorate the Mikdash is not to just continue life as it was, but right? Meaning it's to one, right? We've been knocked down, we'll come back stronger, right? Before, you only took the lulav and esrog every day if you were in the Mikdash. And everybody else relied on the Mikdash. Right? You did it one day, and then every other day, if someone said, where's your lulav and esrog? You says, someone's doing it in Yerushalayim. Right? But now, we don't have the crutch, so to speak, of the Mikdash. So what do? You make every day outside the Mikdash like the Mikdash. Right? That is a totally different way of imagining what Zeichel Mikdash means. Right? I know this was basically the topic that Ora dealt with last week, right? Meaning, if you think about it in a nutshell, right? For those of you here last week, and if you don't, at least you know you should know the basics of this. Right? When Chazal say that there is a position that all of our tefillot are zecher to the karbanot, right? That's actually a very radical statement. Because what are they saying? Right? They're not just saying there used to be three karbanot a day and now there are three tefillot a day. Right? That's what the Gemara says. But think about it for a moment. What are they really saying? The Kohanim in Yerushalayim in the Beit HaMikdash used to perform representative acts of service daily on our behalf so we didn't have to. And now the Mikdash is destroyed, so every Jew, wherever they are, will bring the equivalent of the karban, or some, right, something like the karbanot, wherever they are, right? That's not mourning, that's not token mourning, and that's not even, let's continue the Mikdash. That's, we don't have the Mikdash to rely on. Let's reimagine what Mikdash would look like if it was refracted through the lens of the individual Jew, wherever they might be, outside the confines of the priestly Kodesh. But in the average day life, what would it look like to live Mikdash without Mikdash? Right? That is a very radical, right? It's extremely radical when you think about it, claim about what it means to live life post-Mikdash. Right? It's not just, we can survive this and keep doing what we did. It's the way we survive tragedy is by taking on responsibilities. Right? Lahavdil. Right? If, God forbid, right, a family loses a parent. Right? So, one way for them to continue is everybody keeps doing what they're doing. Right? How do they, let's say it was the main breadwinner in the family who passed away, Nagid the father, okay? So everyone will keep doing what they did. The kids will keep going to school, and the mother will keep her job and keep doing the pickups, but how will they fill in the role that the father had, right? So either they have life insurance and they'll deal with that, and or the mother will get remarried or whatever will happen, right? And somehow you'll like fill all those roles, and some of the roles won't get filled, right? The emotional role won't get filled, or it'll remarry and try to fill it as much as possible, right? That's one way, right? They survive it, right? You keep life going as much as you can. The other way is for, right, and you see this sometimes, right? I mean, where the older children say, look, let's say you have an 18-year-old son and a 6-year-old son, right? The 18-year-old son says, look, when I was 6, I had a father figure who did X, Y, and Z for me. Brought me to, parent-child learning, right? Now my six-year-old brother doesn't have a father. So what do? I will take my brother to parent-child learning, right? Meaning the recognition of mourning forces the other members of the family to pick up responsibilities that they used to take for granted were the father's role. Right? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is saying, what is Zecher LeMikdash? Zecher LeMikdash means there was once a certain dimension of spirituality that was accomplished by the Mikdash, but if there's no Mikdash, then everyone has to up their game and act as if they are now the representatives of the Mikdash outside the confines of Yerushalayim, because there is no Mikdash. Right? And it's not just here. Right? It's not just here. So you continue, right? The other halachi says is v'shiyeh yom hanef kulo asur. What does yom hanef kulo asur mean? So, Ariel smiling. What does yom hanef kulo asur mean? Right? It means that, right? You weren't allowed to eat until you had the new grain. Until you brought the omer, right? And there's a question of when exactly are you allowed to bring? When can you start eating without the karban HaOmer? At the beginning of the day on the 16th, or do you have to wait till the 17th? Okay? So, technically, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says you're allowed to eat it from when there's no karban, from the beginning of the 16th of Nisan. But he says every year now, you should wait until the end of the 16th. Why? Because. So what does he say? My taima. Mehiri yibaneh beit hamikdash. Because the mikdash is coming. Because next year there'll be a mikdash, and the halacha is when there's no mikdash, you can eat the new grain starting at the morning of the 16th. If there is a mikdash, you have to wait till the karban is brought. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says we have to be worried that next year there'll be a mikdash already, and people will make a mistake. Now that's not quite what he did before, but it shares the same sort of, right, emotional approach, which is, right, we have confidence that, right, here you have sort of two parts for Yochanan ben Zakkai, right? One is we up our game post Mikdash, and the other is we live constantly with the optimistic belief that the Mikdash is coming. And we live our life with a consciousness of the fact that, right, this galut is temporary. Right? Those both stem from a certain, right, optimistic orientation of how we deal with the Chorban. Now you see this again in number 9. The Mishnah says, Yom Tov Rosh Hashanah Shechaliot B'Shabbat, if the first day of Rosh Hashanah falls on Shabbos, so B'Migdash Hayu Tokin, Avalo B'Medina. In the Mikdash, you would blow the shofar, but not outside the Mikdash. Mishacharav Beit HaMikdash, but once the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, Hitkin Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai Shiyu Tokin Bechol Makom Sheish Bo Beit Din. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, whatever there's a court, whatever is centralized authority, that's Yerushalayim. We blow the shofar on Shabbos in those places. Now again, right, this is the same thing we saw before by the Lulav. What does he say? In the time of the Beit HaMikdash, Yerushalayim was unique. Post Beit HaMikdash, Yerushalayim is wherever there's a centralized Jewish authority. Right? Whatever is the Beit Din, now you all blow the shofar, even on Shabbos. Because now you are the Mikdash. You are Yerushalayim. Right? This is conceptually, right, exactly what he did in the Arba Minim. And Amar Rilazar, Lohitkin Ryokhman Zakai al Yavna Bilvad. Rilazar says, hey, he didn't say everywhere, he said in Yavna. Okay? But even that, right, right, what's significant about Yavna? Why Yavna? It's the seat of the Sanhedrin. But it's more than that. Think about this now agadically and not halachically. Yeah, Hilly.
It was the center after.
So first of all, it was the first center post-Mikdash. And also, right, what else is this? Remember the Agadata in, you know, the Agadata you're allowed to learn every year on Tisha B'Av, right? Yeah, so Kamsa Bar Kamsa, then they destroy the Beit HaMikdash, and then what happens? Right, there's the fight between the zealots and the rabbis, right? And the rabbis say, right? Let's not burn down the storehouses, right? We can live here for 3 years. And the zealots say, let's burn it down to force your hands. And in the meantime, right, who smuggles out? And what does he say? He smuggles himself out and he gets to the Caesar, right? And what does he say? What do I want? Because he knows the Beit HaMikdash is going to be destroyed. So what does he say? Tainli Yavne v'chachameha. Right? Give me Yavne and the Chachamim. Meaning, his approach was literally, if we're not going to have the Mikdash, at least let me set up a center of Torah learning. And then what does he come and say, according to Elazar? He then said, and that is the new Yerushalayim. Right? Tainli Yavne v'chachameha. And now he says, and that moment of Yavne is not just, give me rabbis. Right? Good, you're our 10th from Minyan. Perfect, perfect. It's, right, we are going to create a new Yerushalayim without the Beit HaMikdash. Right, you realize what he's actually saying when he says, Tein li yavne v'chachameha. Right, isn't just, well, at least let's have Torah. It's, with Torah we'll create a new Jerusalem. Right, that's quite, right, that is a radical statement, but it's consistent with his approach before. Now, afterwards, there is this wonderful moment, right? I once heard a shiur when I was in YU by former chief rabbi, Lord, Sir, whatever, rabbi, you know, whatever, where he said this was his favorite gemara in all of Shas, right? Where they use humor to deal with a difficult situation. So what happens? So, Pam achat chal Rosh Hashanah liyot b'shabbat, v'ayu kol harim kansim, v'amr lehem riyuchum en zakai, l'vinei b'teira nitka. Amr lo nidon. So, it once happened, as can be expected, that Shabbos fell on Rosh Hashanah, right? This happens time to time. So, they got into a machloket. Some of the rabbis, the B'nai B'teira, said, let's not blow the shofar, we need to discuss this first. And Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai said, let's just blow the shofar. So then he says, look, I got a compromise for you. Nitka v'achar kach nidam. Look, we don't have time to have a full machloket in the base medrash right now. So, here's the deal. We'll blow the shofar this year my way, but we won't set policy, right? We'll blow the shofar today, because in the end of the day, it's just a rabbinic law, right? To not blow shofar on Shabbos is just rabbinic, so let's do it now, right? And then we'll talk about it later, and we'll figure out what policy should be for the long term, when we have time to think about it. So that's what they did. They said, okay, fine, once we can deal with it. So then he says, so la'achar shetaku, so they blew. And now they said, okay, let's keep the deal. Let's talk about it in the Beis Medrash. Amar lehem, kfar nishma keren v'yavne. V'ein mashiv in lachar ma'isa. They said, what's there to talk about? We already blew the shofar on Shabbos. And once it's happened, everybody knows the halacha. Right? It's this brilliant moment. But if you think about it, right? Remember, right, Sachs talked about it. It's actually nice. I mean, what does he do? Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai is so convinced that the way we need to move forward post-Mikdash is that we need to recreate Yerushalayim, that he is not going to take no for an answer. And if it takes trickery and humor and, right, wonderfully brilliant ploys that we can all laugh about to trick the other rabbis into making sure that he gets his way, then that's what he's going to do. Right? Because he is convinced. And yes, you read the story and it's actually quite funny because you can all sort of see this happening, right? And you're just like all thinking, which rabbi has that type of sense of humor? Right? But it's actually brilliant. Right, it's brilliant, and he uses this. in 11, I won't read it inside. Is the Gemara in Gittin that I mentioned, right? That this seems to be a function of Tainli Yavne v'Chachameh, right? That's that Gemara, right? Where that was Rabbi Yochanan's request. Now, you see it as well in the Yerushalmi, where there was a machloket about what bracha do you make on the taking of the lulav on the other 7 days. So, ha'kol modim b'yom tov harishon sh'omer al tilat lulav, mafligin v'shar kol hayamim. Everyone agrees that on day one, you say the bracha on the lulav. But they disputed what bracha you make the other 6 days. Rabbi Yochanan Amar al Netilat Lulav, Rabbi Shua ben Levi Amar Mitzvat Zkenim. So Rabbi Shua ben Levi said, I'll let you take the Lulav and Esrog on the other 6 days, but the bracha you make is not, I'm taking the Lulav, because you're not really taking the Lulav. What's the bracha? That we're listening to the rabbis. Right? Meaning, I'll do the act, but this isn't Lulav. Right? This is like some vague pale imitation of lulav. So I'll take the lulav, but I'll make a bracha of, right? We're commanded to listen to the rabbis. And what did Rabbi Yochanan say to him? No. We say the bracha of al netilat lulav all 7 days, because that's Rabbi Yochanan's position on life, right? We recreate the mikdash, and now this isn't just listen to the rabbis, this is lulav, which is shocking. Yeah, Ariel. Is it definitely different Rabbi Yochanan? You're right. It might be a different Rabbi Yochanan. It would still work out. Like, meaning along that approach, I'm not sure. Is it Rosh Hashanah? Yeah, probably, because it's arguing the Rosh Hashanah and Levi. You're right. You're probably right. How much time do we have? Okay, we have a few moments. Okay. Let's look at 12. Now this, you have sort of similar So you have a similar continuation of this theme in the next two sources. So number 12 is relatively well known, because if you ever hear a siyum on Makot, this is where they go. It's the end of Makot. What's less known is what's in 13, which is the parallel version in Avot Deruvin Natan. But let's read both. So the Gemara in Makot tells the following story. Shuv pam achad hayolin liyushalayim keivan sheyigil lahar tzofim karu bigdehem. So, there was a story. There were rabbis going. They were going up to Yerushalayim after the Chorban HaBayit. When they came to the Beit HaMikdash, they tear their clothes in mourning. Kevan she'egiu l'har HaBayit ra'u shu'al she'atzu mi'beit kodshei HaKadoshim etchilu hein bochin ve'Rabbi Akiva mitzachek. Right? This is the famous story of the laughing, right? So, all the rabbis are crying, and Rabbi Akiva is laughing. And then, you get this wonderful dialogue, right? All the rabbis say to Rabbi Akiva, why are you laughing? And he says, why are you crying? And they say, what do you mean, why are we crying? We're at the Beit HaMikdash, and there's foxes just right, walking around on the holiest place on earth. And what does Rabbi Akiva say? That's why I'm laughing. Why am I laughing? Because this is the fulfillment of the tragic prophecies, and the tragic prophecies are followed by optimistic prophecies. Right? Meaning, if God, in fact, destroyed the Beit HaMikdash, and we endured all the tragedies that he said we would in the Nevi'im, then he's also going to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. Right? So Rabbi Kiva's optimism with Mikdash-oriented things is legendary, right? And then they end the story with, right, Akiva Nichamtanu, Akiva Nichamtanu. Okay, Rabbi Kiva, you win. Right? You've consoled us. But a version of this appears in number 13, but the protagonist of that story is not Rabbi Kiva. The protagonist of that story is Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. And this is how it goes. So it's commenting on the first Mishnah in Avot. Sorry, second Mishnah Avot. The second Mishnah in Avot is? Good, right? Shimon HaTzadik haya mishiarei Knesset HaGdola Hu haya omer al shlosha dvarim haolam omed al Torah v'al avodah v'al gmilut chasadim. Right, Shimon HaTzadik is one of the last remaining members of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, and he says the world survives because of three things: Torah and Avodah, right, which is Karbanot and Tefillah, and kindness. So in Avot Rabbi Natan, you get the following: Al Gmilut Chasadim Ketzad. What does it mean that the world is sustained on kindness? Harehu Omer Ki Chesed Chafatzti Velo Zevach. Now watch what Pasuk 8 quotes. Okay? So in the Mishnah, if you just read the Mishnah Avot, what would you have said? Right? What is the Gemara telling you? Sorry, what is the Mishnah telling you? That the world is sustained by three, like exactly what it says, right? It's not like, it's just saying like the world always, like since time immemorial, needs three things: Torah and Avodah and Milah Chasadim. That's it. There's no like, this isn't a historically, this is just a truth about the world. But in Avot Rabbi Natan, it's not true. In Avot Rabbi Natan, it says, Ki chesed chafatzti velo zevach. It's specifically brought up with a pasuk from Hosea, where Hashem says, I want kindness and not karbanot. Meaning what? That according to Avot Rabbi Natan, this is a commentary on what people thought in the time of the Mikdash, which was what? That the most important thing was sacrifice. And even when the Mikdash stood, what did God say? Meaning, it is a timeless truth that the world stands in these three things, but this Mishnah is actually a response, so to speak, to what you might have thought, which is that these things sustain the world in a post-Mikdash era, but in a Mikdash era, you don't need these because you have Karbanot. But in Avot Rabbi Natan, you quote a pasuk that says, no, at some level, we are not lacking anything without the Mikdash. We are. But in a fundamental sense, like the basic elements of the world are still intact. All the world really, really needs is Torah, Avodah, Gemilut, Chasadim. How do I know? Because the Pasuk in Hosea says, Ki chesed chavasti v'lo zevach. That I want kindness, not karbanot. I mean, karbanot are nice. Right? But really, 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 it comes down to these three things. You don't need a Mikdash for that. The world was created originally with kindness. And now you get a story. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was once leaving Yerushalayim. And they were leaving, and they saw, Rabbi Yeshua saw the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. Amar Rabbi Yeshua, Oy lanu al zeh shehu charev. Yeshua says, Oi, woe to us that the Mikdash is destroyed. Makom shemechaprim bo avonotehem shel Yisrael. Woe that we've lost the place where we used to get atonement. Amar le, bini, al yiralecha. And what does Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai say? Don't worry about it. It shouldn't be bad in your eyes. Right? Don't be grieved that we don't have the Mikdash. Yesh lanu kaparacha shikmota. We have other atonement like that. Ve'ezo zeh, what is that? Gmilut chasadim. Shne'emar ki chesed chafat v'lozevach. Shekein matzinu b'Daniel ish chamudot shayam mitasek v'gmilut chasadim. And we know this about Daniel. U'mahen gmilut chasadim shayam Daniel mitasek v'hem. What did Daniel do that was so good, or so kind? Im tomar lodus v'achim. Right, if you're going to say that he brought karbanot, that's not true. Makriv b'Bavel, he didn't bring karbanot in Bavel. Right, Daniel is one of the few, right, one of those books in Tanakh that doesn't take place in Israel. Right, what other books? Quiz, right? What other books don't take place in Israel? Of course, Medea. Esther and? Right, good Shmot, good. Shmot, the Torah, good. The whole Torah, good. What else? What? Yeah, I guess, whatever, Yev, and Yechezkel, right, and Yonah, right, Yonah, but are, anyways, but yes, the Torah would be one of those, right there. Anyways, so, Valok Farnemar, Hisham Elohim Pental Leolotech, Bechoma Komashir, Terekim, Komashir, Harashem, Bachachva, Dechasham Teleolotech, right, you're not allowed to bring carbon outside of Eretz Israel, at least once you have Yerushalayim. Elamahin, Gimilut Chasadim, Shayat Mitasek Bahen. If you don't recognize this word, that's fine. Right, and he says, what did Daniel do? He used to help people as they were getting married, right? He would adorn the brides, and he would escort the dead, right? And he would give tzedakah, and he would daven three times a day. Now, in this version of Avot Rabbi Natan, right, this isn't, right? It's not Rabbi Kiva, it's Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, but specifically, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is coming and saying, right, what's his theology here? Don't think that without the Mikdash, we are lacking something fundamental in our lives. Like, obviously we want the Beit HaMikdash. But don't think we're missing something fundamental. We're not. Because Daniel was fine. Was totally fine. And what did he do? He was kind and he davened. Right? And he achieved the same that you would have gotten in the Mikdash, so you can do it too. And he quotes a pasuk from the time of the Mikdash. Right? Where Hashem says to Hosea, right, even when there was a Mikdash, Hashem said, don't think the Mikdash is the be-all and end-all of Jewish life. It's not. Ki chesed chafatzi v'lo zevach. So I'll prove to you that life can continue, and not just continue, but thrive, and that people can take personal responsibility post-Mikdash. How do I know? Because God said so, even when the Mikdash stood. So of course it's true. Don't be so grieved. Now, number 14, I gave you something that Orah is talking about next week, so I'll just throw it out. Another Gemara that goes in this direction, right? There's two ways of reading it, but right, when the Gemara says that Miyom Shecharav Beit HaMikdash Ein Lo LaKadosh Baruch Hu Be'olamo El Arba Mot Shel Halacha Bilvad, that once the Beit HaMikdash is destroyed, God only has the four cubits of Halacha. Now, one of way of reading that is sad, right? He used to have the Beit HaMikdash, and now he just has Halacha. The other way of reading that is, God used to be focused on the Mikdash, and now Chaval, the only place we find God is wherever anybody happens to keep halacha anywhere in the world, right? Meaning, you realize that that line can be read in two radically, radically different ways. What I'm talking about on Thursday is number 15, which is another claim where Chazal say that shuls and batei medrash are mikdash ma'at. What does mikdash ma'at mean? Again, two ways of reading that. Mikdash ma'at means we used to have the mikdash and now we only have a minor mikdash, or we may only have a minor mikdash, but that minor mikdash is found in every Jewish community, and you show up there every day, as opposed to in the past when, if you wanted to go to the mikdash, you had to show up in Yerushalayim, and now you can show up to at least, maybe not the mikdash, but a version of the mikdash in every community, right? There's a ma'at component of it, but then there's an optimistic component, which is, it used to be you only went to the mikdash 3 times a year, and now you go 3 times a day. You used to have to travel, and now, you know, you build one every street corner. So if we summarize, because now we are in our last 3 minutes, right? The way I started, again, I didn't go through everything. There are so many different things we do that are Zecher LeMikdash. But what I wanted to do is at least open your minds here to what is going on in Chazal, where we tend, even though we experience so many Zecher LeMikdash things, if someone asks you, what is the primary thing that we do that is Zecher LeMikdash, right? Most people, I think, would jump and say, well, 3 weeks a year we mourn, or 4 times a year we fast, Zecher LeMikdash, which is true. Right? A component of Zecher LeMikdash is that we mourn. Right? No one's going to deny that that's part of how we commemorate the Mikdash. But what I think we've seen today is that there are many different levels at which that's true. Yes, sometimes we mourn. But first of all, even within mourning, there's an inherent optimism. When we say, yeah, we mourn 3 weeks a year, and the rest of the year we celebrate. We live life normally, right? There is an optimism in token mourning, right? Or mourning which is intensified in certain periods of the year, which, by definition, leave us to not mourn in that intense way the rest of the year, right? Meaning, by the time Tisha B'Av is over, 6 days later, we're at Tu B'Av, and, you know, you have your other stress of the year, which is, which wedding do I go to on Tu B'Av, right? Meaning there's, right, like, we all know that, right, the sadness of Tisha B'Av dissipates like that, right? Because, right, the summer is wedding season, and as soon as 3 weeks are over, right, you have to catch up for lost time, right? And every time you walk into the bayit, there's a wedding in the morning, there's a wedding in the afternoon, the wedding in the night, right? Like, and then we saw two other levels, right? There are times where we commemorate the Mikdash by performing mitzvot in a hampered way, where we do something, but we draw attention to the sadness. Sometimes we do Zecher LeMikdash by just saying, you know what, life continues as it did before, right? Before we counted Sefer HaOmer, and now we're going to count Sefer HaOmer. But then there's the Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai-esque model, which is sometimes the way that we commemorate the Mikdash is not just by mourning, and not just by having token mourning, and not even by continuing life as it was, but is recognizing that the way to move forward in light of the Churban HaBayit is to say, we used to count on the Mikdash to accomplish a lot of things in Judaism. But without it, we need to pick up the slack. And that, yes, obviously there's a sad component. We want the Beit HaMikdash. But that, in fact, is something to celebrate. And therefore, it actually creates more responsibilities on the individual. And hence, we daven 3 times a day, and the karbanot, which used to be the roles of the kohanim, are now the roles of the individual. It used to be that only in the Mikdash you took the lulav and esrog 7 days. And now, every Jew, wherever they are, can do that. It used to be that only Yerushalayim you blew the shofar. And now, We blow the shofar, right, wherever there's a court. It used to be that people had to be told by God, I want kindness and not karbanot, because there were karbanot and people thought that's what life was about. And Yochanan ben Zakkai says, look, when there was a Beit HaMikdash, God said that's not really what's life about. They're just part of life. But in the end of the day, the core of life is, you know, Torah avod and gemil chasadim, and therefore that still exists in full force post-Mikdash. And now you don't even have karbanot to rely on. God doesn't have to tell you, right, don't rely on karbanot. You just know intuitively, because there are no karbanot, that if we want to survive, you each got to take on responsibilities of Torah avod and gemil chasadim. And it's that last level, right, which is, I think, the one we never think about. But as you see from Yochanan ben Zakkai, is actually a consistent position throughout Shas, that one of the ways we commemorate the Mikdash is not in any of the mourning ways or the incomplete ways or even just we'll survive this ways. But one of them is to recognize that the Mikdash, as much as it was great, it also allowed the individual to outsource responsibility to those functionaries in the Mikdash. And one of the ways that we commemorate the Mikdash is not by being sad, but is by taking on the responsibility that has now devolved on us as individuals and bringing the Mikdash into our own lives, which, yes, has a tragic component, but also is much more filled with optimism than it is with mourning. Right? And therefore, you see that this, right, all these ways in which we commemorate the Mikdash are attempts to integrate Mikdash into our life, integrate the sadness, but also temper it with optimism, responsibility, to make it that the Mikdash is both a something we yearn for, but also something that animates us in a positive way in how we live our post-Mikdash lives in a way that actually has positive consequences and not just the negative ones. Okay, with that, Maariv.